So what does wellness mean to you? Welcome to another episode of Wellness Wednesdays. I'm your host, Eric Clark. This week, we get another special guest, Dr. Ruwan Amaratanga, a sleep physician who specializes in the... help me out here.
I just do sleep medicine. I'm also a pulmonary physician.
So okay. That's my background. Yeah. I don't want to get too technical for the podcast, but I think we'll get into some great sleep stuff. So first of all, we'll start at the beginning. How did you get into this stuff?
So as I mentioned, I'm primarily a sleep physician, a pulmonary physician. And one of the rotations sort of that you do in your pulmonary training is sleep medicine, specifically obstructive sleep apnea, which is probably the biggest part of our job in sleep medicine. And to be honest, the first time I did my sleep medicine rotation, I didn't actually like it. I thought it was not very interesting. But I did another round of it, and I was actually, my mind was changed. And the thing that changed me was that I actually realized what a difference that I could make for people. You know, when you do things in pulmonary medicine, sometimes you don't always make people feel that much better. But in sleep medicine, if you can make someone going from, you know, having poor sleep to good sleep, they feel a lot better, and that was really rewarding. There's also a whole bunch of other less common things in sleep medicine which I got exposed to, like narcolepsy.
Every time you say that, I think of Deuce Bigelow. I think most people don't have, I mean, in their day-to-day. So
that's right, yeah. I mean, I think there's definitely sort of a certain portrayal in popular culture of narcolepsy, which doesn't really reflect the truth.
The truth's not always as funny.
Absolutely. I agree. It's not funny. But yeah, so I did it a second time, and I just found it rewarding and really interesting. So that's how I got into it.
We'll take one step back before we kind of go forward. What made you want to be a doctor?
That's a good question. Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, from a young age, I was interested in science. My dad was a professor of engineering, and he just taught me to really, you know, be curious about the world, and be interested in science and to never stop questioning things. And for some reason, biology just seemed to really suit me, and medicine just sort of fell out of that, I think. You know, the ability to actually make a difference in people's lives was a big one. But something about just medicine itself, you know, the human body and trying to diagnose when it goes wrong and fix it is just fascinating to me. And the other thing too is it's because it's people that we're talking about. You know, there's always a lot of funding for research, and in other words, that the field is always progressing. So it's something that I figured would always be new and challenging throughout my life. And those are the biggest reasons that I did medicine. Yeah.
And what you brought up a good point about kind of the research, and a lot of stuff is happening, especially the last 5-10 years. I think it's very exciting in the field of medicine and health and all that stuff. But what's been some of the great discoveries in your field?
Well, you know, sleep medicine specifically is, you know, still really in its infancy, right, compared to most other specialties. So I don't know if we've had many... you know, dramatic breakthroughs, although I'm sure if there's a sleep researcher listening to me, they would disagree. I mean, clearly, you could say that, in the context of because it's in its infancy, there actually has been a lot of progress because we didn't know anything 20 years ago. One interesting breakthrough in sleep, I suppose, would be, you know, just understanding the physiology of narcolepsy, understanding there's actually a neurotransmitter that's missing in the brain. That's something people didn't know. Certainly on my other side of practice in the respirology world, there's always huge advancements. The biggest one there, I would have to say, probably is in the treatment of lung cancer. We've gone from, you know, having it being a very, very poor prognosis to having anything really after stage one lung cancer to now almost being able to cure stage four because we've developed molecular therapies for cancer. So we can use antibodies, which target cancer inside of your own body, and we can really make people a lot better. You know, it works because as contrasted to chemotherapy, it doesn't know how to differentiate between your cells and cancer cells. I mean, in some ways they are the same.
Yeah.
The only difference is cancer cells replicate really quickly, so we try and attack them, but then you also hurt your other quickly replicating cells like hair and stuff. But with antibodies against cancerous molecules, you can really target therapy. It's pretty incredible, actually.
Yeah. And hopefully the field of sleep and cancer kind of keeps going, because I think a lot of people need both.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of talk recently about sleep and the benefits of sleep, especially good sleep. Why do you think that is? And it's only been recently, like we've talked a bit before. I don't think many people would put sleep in the health category probably even 10 years ago. Yeah. But now, I mean, there's a lot of books. There's a lot of podcasts, and there's podcasts just about sleep. There's a lot of information out there. So what's been the kind of the resurgence of sleep?
It's a good question.
Is it because we know more about it now? And
I would say certainly. I mean, as we research and as we've learned more about it in the last, I said, 10 to 15 years, right, it's just made its way to the public. More primary care physicians think about it when people say that they're tired, and that wouldn't have been the case 15 years ago, right? We would have just done the blood work, looking at your iron and thyroid, and that would have been it. Yeah. There's also an
understanding. Which is kind of weird when you say that now. Like, it's like, yeah. Oh, yeah, you wouldn't think they'd look at your sleep if people are tired, but yeah, I understand what you're saying.
There's also the understanding that obstructive sleep apnea is not just a disease of people who are obese, right? This was the thought even 10 years ago, right? But we know that young people, slender people can all have obstructive sleep apnea. There's different... it's just not the prototype we used to have. And I think, you know, there's a broader point that's important, and that's just in our society, specifically North America. You know, we live a very fast-paced life, and it's all about productivity and success and money and all these kinds of things. And, you know, there's a lot of sayings in our society, like, oh, I'll sleep when I'm dead, and these kinds of things, which, you know, that was just the way it was. And I think people it's just a pendulum. People have been getting burnt out. Maybe we see the increases in health problems, and people are understanding that they have to take care of themselves. And I hope that's what it is.
Yeah.
I think that's part of it. Yeah.
And, I mean, personally, I've been really putting a lot of emphasis on my sleep, probably a few years ago. Partly it was because of the monitoring stuff that we have.
Yes.
I can tell. I mean, again, I'm sure it's not as accurate as some of the other stuff, but for me, it gives me some good feedback and say, okay, how long have I been sleeping? What's been the quality? Like, again, it's not a medical grade device, but at least it gives me a pretty good indication. And it's sometimes like, oh yeah, I only slept 6 hours last night because I was out late or had to get up early for a meeting.
Yes.
And for me, the biggest indicator is my resting heart rate.
Yes.
And it's fairly accurate again.
Yeah.
We can argue all day with how accurate it is, but at least it gives me a barometer. Like, if doing so well, if my heart rate's 50, I know I'm doing a little bit better. And there's also been talking about successful people. Arianna Huffington, I don't know if you know, she is from the Huffington Post, came out with a book about how she had a breakdown and sleep kind of brought her back. And,
of course.
And so for me, sleep is a priority. Mm. I try to get my 7-8 hours a night. And I don't feel as productive if I don't.
Yeah.
And so I've been reading up on sleep and trying to really kind of create some sleep hygiene. But before we get into some tips for sleep hygiene, can you explain to the average person what is sleep apnea and how what kind of people get it? And I know the concept it might be a misconception. It's mostly obese people that, you know, have blocked airways. But can you just kind of make it a little bit, because I don't think it affects everyone that's going to be listening to podcasts, but it just so that you kind of, I don't want to say dumb it down, but make it a little more accessible for
sure.
For
folks. Yeah. So obstructive sleep apnea,
and it's fairly dangerous. It can be depending
on the severity of it.
Okay.
Right? So obstructive sleep apnea is a condition whereby when you are asleep, your airway is either partly or completely collapsing. And so when your airway is partly or completely collapsed, therefore you have less airflow, and that can result in a drop in oxygen. The consequences of that event, though, aside from dropping your oxygen, which doesn't always happen, but the consequence is that you have an arousal. So in other words, your body has to kind of wake itself up a little bit to open up the airway. And in doing so, you have a surge of what we call catecholamines. So things like adrenaline, cortisol, these kinds of things. And
doesn't sound very restful.
Well, right. Yeah. And that raises your heart rate and it raises your blood pressure. And you can imagine that this is happening very frequently throughout the night. That if you're always having these spikes of adrenaline, it's sort of like you're not really sleeping. Rather, it's like you're exercising all night, right? And we're supposed to do this thing called dipping while we sleep. So our heart rate and blood pressures are supposed to drop while we're asleep. And actually, that's what allows us to maintain a normal blood pressure in the daytime. And so if you have this constant, you know, impulse.
Spikes, yeah.
Exactly. Your blood pressure and heart rate don't drop at night. And then therefore, they will go up in the daytime. And so, that's just one aspect of it. But, you know, this can happen in us, but in a normal individual, it's less than 5 times an hour. If it's more than 5 times an hour, that's sleep apnea. If it's 5 to 15, it's mild. 15 to 30 an hour is moderate. And more than 30 times an hour is actually severe obstructive sleep apnea. Mm. And that's where we believe that there are significant risks. So if you don't treat that, the best data we have suggests that you increase your risk of heart attack, stroke, and even death in your sleep by over 200%. We know...
That's pretty considerable.
Okay. It is pretty considerable. We also know that it raises your risks of depression, high blood pressure, as I mentioned, diabetes, because it affects your blood sugar. And it can also impair your driving, as well as your other daytime productivity. When it comes to driving, the biggest issue there is reaction time. So we know that your reaction time is absolutely reduced. And that can even happen with 1 or 2 hours of sleep less than a normal person gets. But if you have severe obstructive sleep apnea impaired, risks of car accidents go up by well over 500%.
So, again, another fairly considerable effect.
Yeah, for both the individual and the public in general, right? I mean, it's serious. Yeah.
So how do you treat that? Is it the one of those masks from NN?
So again, it really depends on the severity. The principle here, obviously, is we want to keep the airway open, right? That's the simplest point I can make. If it's just mild, you know, sometimes just sleeping on your side is sufficient. Weight loss, if you have weight to lose, can absolutely be helpful. But as the severity goes up, sometimes those things alone aren't sufficient. And so then you have to use an adjunct, right? So the other options, really, there aren't that many, but one is something called Provent, these things you put on your nostrils.
Oh, yeah. The strips that keep them...
No, those are Breathe Right strips.
Okay.
These are stickers you put over your nostrils. And when you breathe in, there's no problem. But when you exhale, that creates a resistance.
Okay.
That resistance creates pressure.
Oh.
The pressure opens the airway.
Oh, okay.
Again, doesn't really work for severe apnea too well, but that's one option. Another thing is a mandibular advancement device. So that's a mouthpiece you have custom designed for your mouth.
Okay.
And it causes your mandible, the lower jaw, to protrude, which actually pulls your tongue forward and also sort of just tightens up the airway a little bit while you're asleep.
Okay.
So it sort of prevents the airway from collapsing again. And that tends to work, again, for less severe cases, but also really positional cases.
Yeah.
And then finally, you do have CPAP, which stands for Continuous Positive Airway Pressure, and that's the mask, which is attached to a machine via a hose.
Yeah.
And what that does is it takes room air, humidifies it using a distilled water chamber, and then pressurizes it, and then puts that air into your throat. And simply put, all it's doing is using air pressure to just hold or splint open your airway to prevent this problem. Yeah.
I can't, I'm lucky I don't have sleep apnea, but I can't imagine that being comfortable when you're sleeping, having a hose hooked up to your mouth. It's probably better than not sleeping at all.
Well, it is. And again, the hard part is falling asleep with it.
Yeah.
Once you are asleep, you're unconscious, so you don't know you're wearing it.
Yeah.
And B, because it's treating your apnea, once you fall asleep, your sleep will actually be better and you will stay asleep.
Yeah.
I should also mention that one other thing, that if you, there is also upper airway surgery. I didn't mention that.
Yeah.
And that really is only best for people who have very, very large tonsils.
Yeah.
Some people who have really, really posterior jaws, we can actually like surgically sort of break them and advance them. But again, those are extreme cases.
Yeah. And are those... Those, I'm assuming, aren't common, the surgery part?
No, the surgery is actually much more common in young people because their problem is almost always tonsils.
Yeah.
And so it's highly effective for them.
To just get the tonsil removed?
Yeah, and their adenoids sometimes. They might get their uvula removed. It depends on the individual case, of course. But yes, it's definitely more effective in people who have large tonsils, especially if they're younger, basically, is how I would summarize that.
Now let's get into good sleep. Like we've gotten some bad stuff. Now let's get into some good stuff. As a physician, a sleep physician, what would you consider good sleep? Like, well, what are some of the markers that you look at? Is it duration? Is it less tossing and turning? What do you look for in a...
Right. So at the end of the day, the simplest thing I would say is, do you feel well when you wake up in the morning, and do you feel well rested and energetic throughout the day? If that's happening, chances are you have good sleep, right? To give you more detail than that, I would say on top of that, probably you should be getting somewhere between 7 and 9 hours of sleep. A number of years ago, they did a large study and they showed, the median amount of sleep you need was 8.17 hours. I mean, that's just a number.
Yeah.
And the range is 7 to 9. There are certainly people who could exist outside of that and be okay. But that's definitely a rarity. We know that people who get less than 6 hours of sleep for sure have a much higher incidence of heart problems. They don't live as long, even though they may believe they feel fine. So getting enough sleep, having a regular pattern of sleep, and feeling rested, those are the markers that you're having good sleep. If you're sleeping, 8 or 9 hours a night regularly, and you don't feel well rested in the morning, or you're falling asleep in the daytime, that is a sign that you are having a problem of some kind. It doesn't necessarily mean you have organic sleep issues. I mean, mood spectrum disorders like anxiety and depression can absolutely give you those symptoms, even though your sleep might be fine technically.
Yeah.
But yes, that would be the red flag for sure.
And what constitutes sleep hygiene for you in terms of like, is there good sleep hygiene routines that, because I've really changed mine recently some of the research, and I was just listening to a podcast this week about EMF. And I mean, I've been good. I've been putting my phone in a different room.
Okay.
And then also like all the notifications are off on my phone, like all these little things.
Yes.
But there's a lot of people that's the first, like, and I don't use my phone as my alarm anymore. Like,
yes,
all these little things.
Yes.
And where a lot of people, I mean, I think cell phones or smartphones especially they're great, but they're also the devil.
Yes.
Because we rely on them so much. And then, so what constitutes kind of good sleep?
So I'm going to spout off a bunch of things here, and it might sound like I basically don't want anyone to have any fun.
Yeah. That's okay. You're a doctor. That's probably okay.
That's certainly not it. And certainly, if you are someone who's doing the things I'm going to mention and you sleep well and you feel fine, I mean, you don't have to do these things. But certainly the best approach to having good quality sleep, the things that you can do are as follows. So one, as you said, maintain a regular bedtime and maintain a regular wake time. And
there can be some variation. It doesn't have to be like falling asleep at 9:08 and then waking up at 6:53.
And so the body is somewhat flexible, and definitely an hour plus or minus on either end is, I think, within the realm of tolerance. But life gets in the way, and sometimes you're busy one night and you go to bed late.
Thursday night football or Monday night football.
Right. And so in those instances, believe it or not, the most important thing to actually maintain is your wake time. Okay. And again, if you go to bed 3 hours later, what I'm suggesting is that you don't sleep in 3 hours later. If anything, as I mentioned, maybe 1 hour later. And this is important.
It's a good tip.
Yeah, it's important because really it's your wake time that sets your rhythm and tone for the whole day. And, if you go to bed late one day and then you wake up roughly at the proper or regular time in the morning, that will at least allow you, you're going to be tired that day. There's no doubt. You should be. You went to bed later. But that impetus will allow you to go to bed at the normal time, if not earlier. And that is how you should catch up on your sleep. And then again, wake up the next day at the normal time. Because if you don't do that, right, if you sleep, you go to bed 3 hours later, and you sleep in 3 hours later, then you could, especially if you do it more than one or two nights in a row, you could then start to shift your whole clock forward. And that's obviously not good. So that's one really big thing, is sleep hours and flexibility, and I would say focusing on a regular wake time above all. Now, when it comes to nighttime, the thing that's going to give you success at having a similar bedtime is your routine. So most of the time, what I would say is if you want to have success there, you need to actually be getting ready 1 hour before bedtime. And that means just winding down, right? It means not looking at electronics, if you can help it. It means settling in, reading something, taking a hot bath is actually good.
What about a cold bath?
Well, I guess that would be individual preference. Yeah. The literature talks about warm baths, but you know what? If you like a cold bath, that's fine. So long as it's not something that really wakes you up, right? That's kind of the difference, right? People like.
But I find if I take a long cold shower before bed, I sleep.
Then perfect. Then that works for you. So there's nothing wrong with that. And just settling in into a routine, and that will allow you to kind of to sleep regularly. You know, we've learned very recently in the last 5 to 7 years that how important light stimulus is, and how electronic screens really can affect our circadian rhythm, our ability to fall asleep and have a normal sleep cycle. We discovered that there are receptors, a third class of receptors inside of your eyes, not just rods and cones, but a third kind, which specifically deals with a wavelength of blue light, which we normally get from the sun, but also we get from electronic screens. And so when you use that at night, especially if the rest of the room is dark, then you're getting a high concentration of that light, which is going to make it harder to fall asleep and also degrade the quality of your sleep. The other thing, too, is substances. So caffeine, big one. It can last for 8 hours and definitely degrades the quality of your sleep. So that's a huge one.
What about alcohol?
Yeah, alcohol is another big one in this society. So alcohol takes about 4 hours to metabolize. And so really, you shouldn't have that within 4 hours of sleep. There's the impression that alcohol gives you good sleep because, sure, it puts you out, right?
Boom!
Exactly. But there's a bunch of things that change, right? So, in fact, it actually gives you a bit more deep sleep, but it suppresses REM.
Yeah.
And then REM, rapid eye movement sleep. And then when it wears off 4 hours later, you have a big surge in REM. These things might sound good, but the other thing it does is that it raises your body temperature because you're metabolizing it. And body temperature is very, very important to sleep quality. And we rely on your body temperature dropping. And in fact, once it hits its lowest point, almost always within 2 to 3 hours from that point, you will wake up. That's the way your sleep physiology works. And if you take alcohol and you raise your temperature, that process will be significantly inhibited. Mm-hmm. It also goes to your points about other sleep hygiene, keeping your room cool, right? A cold room is definitely better for sleep. You can put on a cover and keep yourself warmer, right? But you can take that off if you're too hot. If your room is too hot, there's nothing you can really do, right? Yeah. Maybe a fan if you're lucky. Yeah. And also light, by the way. I didn't even mention that, but you know, having as dark a room as possible. Blackout curtains are good. Making sure you don't have bright alarm clock lights or bright lights, cover them all up. Yeah. And if you can't, getting a sleep mask, you know, with something that has a bulge for the eyes so you can't feel it can also be really helpful. Further to that point, alarm clocks, okay? Really important that if you wake up in the middle of the night that you never look at the time. Never.
you just killed about half the people.
Yes, never. It serves absolutely no purpose. And it introduces stress and decision-making into the middle of the night that should not otherwise be there, right?
Yeah.
If you have a specific time that you have to wake up, set an audio alarm, right? Set your clock to make a buzzer.
Yeah.
And don't look at the time.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, the clock will tell you when you have to get up.
I don't know if it's human nature, but most of us, the first thing we do when we wake up in the middle of the night is just, it's like, look at your watch or look at the clock or whatever.
Of course. That's human nature.
It's a very good, I'm going to really try not to now.
Yeah, it's human nature, but it's it works against you.
Yeah.
The simple example that I would give you is that, you know, hopefully you've heard of people who set their alarm at 6 and after a while they start to wake up at 5:59.
Yeah.
Right? That's not a coincidence, right? That's training.
Yeah.
We have an innate internal clock. And whenever you wake up, for whatever reason, if you look at the time, you're making an association there, right? And so while that's really great, if it works just before you want to wake up, imagine you're waking up at 1 or 2 in the morning and you look at the time and then you do that a few nights in a row. And then you can train yourself to wake up at 1 or 2 in the morning.
Yeah.
And that's not good, right? Yeah. So don't ever look at the time.
So how would you, let's say, someone does wake up at 2 a.m.
Yeah.
And what was the best way to fall back asleep?
This is a really good question. So the core problem with repeatedly waking up at the same time or not, basically just not sleeping well at night, is that you develop a negative subconscious association with your room and your bed. Mm. When you look at your bed at night, or when you're going to bed, your brain should think, man, I love this place. This is the best, right? But if you struggle constantly at night, that association will change. Even if you don't think it out loud, your brain is thinking, oh man, I wonder what's gonna happen tonight, right? How long is it going to take me this time? When am I going to wake up? And that's bad, right? I mean, you don't want that. So the whole point of what I'm about to suggest is with the goal of breaking that cycle. So if you believe it's been more than 20 minutes, okay, you don't know because you're not looking at the clock.
Yeah.
But if you think it's been more than 20 minutes and you're wide awake, you have to actually get out of your bed and you have to go to a different room. So this is the most important thing that I can say.
Yeah.
Now, when you go to this different room, you also have to set yourself up for success. So you need to find a room that is dark, again, that is cool, and sit up in sort of a reclining position if you could. And you have two options now, really only two. You could stare at the wall, which is quite painful, or you could read something that you do not like. Okay? So dictionary, unless you... you know, etymology is your thing, then don't read a dictionary, but instruction manual, something. In other words, something that's not going to be rewarding or stimulating. You definitely should not watch the television. You definitely should not use electronics, again, because of that blue light that I was talking about. And as you do this boring, mundane thing, you should start to fall asleep. And if and when that happens, then you go to bed. If it doesn't happen, unfortunately, you just stay awake all night. And then if you repeat this pattern, you know, eventually you're going to increase your sleep drive, right? Because that day is going to be terrible because you didn't sleep.
Yeah.
And you're going to try and just go to bed earlier and earlier. And so long as you keep following these rules, you will be able to retrain yourself. That's a mixture of sleep hygiene and what we call sleep restriction therapy.
I've been doing a lot of breathing exercises before bed, and I find that's really helped just to kind of slow down
for sure
the breathing rhythm.
Yep.
And
That's a whole other thing, you know, mindfulness.
Yeah. Or meditation. I find like yoga or meditation before bed usually also helps.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's all the same idea, right? Yeah. It's winding down. Now, you know, meditation is not an easy thing to do.
Especially, I think most people that can't fall asleep probably can't do meditation either.
That's right.
Because most likely the hamster thinking. Brain that's kind of
exactly.
Going on,
and at the end of the day, you know, if this is the problem, this is what we call psychophysiologic insomnia. So it's basically maladaptive behaviors, external factors, which are negatively impacting your sleep. That's what all of this, that's the umbrella term for all of this. And if all of these general pieces of advice I've given don't work, what we do is we often ask you to see a sleep psychologist, and they do something called cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. And a lot of that is really what I just went over, but in much more detail and in an organized fashion, right? And that is actually very effective for this kind of issue with insomnia. But of course, I should just be clear, in that instance, you have to make sure there's no other underlying organic sleep problem, right? We shouldn't ignore the fact that insomnia, one of the major causes for insomnia in our society is obstructive sleep apnea.
Yeah.
Right? People just don't realize that what's happening is they're falling into sleep and they're coming right out of it. It's called microsleep. They don't even realize that they fell asleep. But the reason they kept coming out is because their airway is starting to collapse. And a lot of people just have no idea.
Well, it's, I mean, I'm learning so much, and it's, I think we talk about this all day, but I know you're a busy gentleman, so I have to be mindful of your time. Before we go, two questions. One is a question I ask all my guests on the podcast. What does wellness mean to you?
Oh, wow. That's a good question. Honestly, wellness is making sure that you don't forget about yourself and your needs. I think that's, to me, what wellness is. There's so much impetus and push in the society, again, as I mentioned, to be productive and to be, you know, successful. And for what most people, or at least the cultural definition of that is, you know, money and, you know,
fame and sports cars.
Right. All those things. But, you know, life goes by quickly. I'm not saying it's short, but it moves quickly. And we all have passions and things that we love in our life that don't necessarily have anything to do with our job, right? And so you have to make sure that you take time for yourself to do things that make you happy, and that you take care of your health, because you only have one body. And that's what wellness is for me. It's, you know, it's just not forgetting to take care of yourself, you know, to do the things that make you happy. And, you know, that money doesn't bring you happiness, right? So
that's what I heard, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty good definition. I'm sure sleep is in there somewhere, too. Good sleep, yeah.
Yeah. That's more taking care of yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. So if people want to find out more about kind of sleep hygiene, sleep stuff, or find more about kind of your services, where can they get information?
Yeah, good question. In this day and age, a big problem people have is looking on the internet and not ever paying attention to the quality or credibility of the source material. You know, the Mayo Clinic has good information on sleep on their website. The NIH in the United States, again.
What does that stand for?
National Institute of Health.
Okay.
And again, in the U.S. Those are two really excellent sources where you could get just general information on sleep. Of course, if you believe you have any sleep difficulties, then you should ask your doctor to see a sleep physician. I work here at the MOFOR, and there's also the West Ottawa Sleep Center where I also work.
Okay. Well, again, thank you very much. Thank you very much for your time.
It's my pleasure.
Yeah, it's been great. And I think that because a lot of people, again, sleep is kind of, I don't want to say hot right now, but I think more people are paying attention.
Good.
And we might have to do a part two and get into some more geeking out some more stuff.
Sure. Anytime.
All right. Thanks. You've been listening to Wellness Wednesdays. I'm your host, Eric Clark. Until next week, be well.